You're tuned to WPKN Radio. I'm Kevin Gallagher, and my guest right now is WPKN's own talking head, Chris Franz of Talking Heads and the Tom Tom Club fame. He is here to talk about his new book called Remain in Love, where he reminisces about his extraordinary experience with these two remarkable bands, and all the while being married, and most importantly, remaining in love with his bandmate, the great bass player Tina Weymouth. Let me welcome one of the nice guys in the music world to my show, Chris Franz. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you, Kevin. What a great pleasure.
Well, you know, all I can say is, after reading your book, is what a life. What do you think about it when you look back over your career when you were happening? I mean, you were really happening from the mid-70s to the early 90s. There was nobody fresher, nobody hipper than the Talking Heads and Tom Tom Club, for that matter. What do you think about it, looking back over it?
Well, I thank you for the kind words. You know, I think we were very fortunate to be in the right place at the right time when we arrived in New York in 1974. And there was something going on already that, when we arrived, you know, in the lofts of Soho and the, you know, the clubs of the East Village and stuff. And there was, you know, people such as Philip Glass and Trisha Brown and Twyla Tharp and Vito Acconci. But then there was also Patti Smith and the Ramones and a band called Television. And so it was just a real cultural motherlode, I guess you could say, happening right at that time with both the avant-garde and also rock and roll. So we landed right in the middle of that in the fall of 1974. And we thought, yep, we made the right decision moving here to New York. This is where it's at. You know, we started working on songs and trying to put a band together, David and I. And also I was trying to get Tina to join the band and had been for a long time. She hadn't committed to that yet. She was still... We had come from art school, you know, from the Rhode Island School of Design. And she had just received a degree in painting. And so naturally, she was excited about doing some painting. But one thing led to another. And one day, Tina walked into our loft on Christie Street with a 1963 Fender Precision bass that she had been putting $5 a week down on We Buy Guitars up on 48th Street. And, you know, it took a long time. And I think it was her 24th birthday. Her parents gave her $100 and she was able to make the final payment with that. She still didn't have an amplifier, but now she had a bass guitar.
So let's talk about Tina for a minute. If anything, this book is a great love note to your life partner, Tina.
Yeah.
Tell us something about her that's not rock and roll, and then explain to everyone out there just how good a bass player she is. You know, I mean, she came up with some of the most original riffs for, like, Izimbra, Cities, Once in a Lifetime, and everybody, of course, knows as soon as Psycho Killer starts. You know, these are some major original riffs that she came up with. And explain to everybody a little bit about Tina in both ways.
Well, Tina had played like folk guitar. And she had also played the flute, and she had also done, when she was quite young, she was in an English handbell ringing group. They actually performed at the New York World's Fair. You know who also performed at the World's Fair that summer was Bob Marley, a very young Bob Marley. But anyway, Tina knew about music, and she loved music. But she had never played rock and roll, or certainly not bass. One thing that was cool about her parts that she came up with was they were not based on, you know, the rudiments of rock and roll. They were not based on Chuck Berry licks or the blues necessarily. Sometimes they could be kind of bluesy, but they were actually more classical sounding to me than your typical rock and roll bass part of that day. The sound of her bass combined with David's sort of off-kilter vocals and very high, trebly, almost high-life guitar that David, style that David played in, and my, you know, drums. I was always interested in trying to move the audience to dance. So I tended to have, you know, pretty, how shall I say, simple yet effective drum patterns. And so the three of us had a really interesting chemistry, and we came up with some great material in that loft on Christie Street.
Sure then, did.
And then when things started to get serious, we brought, after a couple of years of performing at CBGB's and around New York, we added Jerry Harrison, who had been with the Modern Lovers, and that the Modern Lovers split up. And Jerry had entered a master's program for architecture at Harvard. And we had to convince him to drop everything and join our band, which took some doing. Like, I think it's the first time a band ever auditioned for a keyboard player.
That's great of Jerry. So yeah. I mean, what did he add to the equation? What did he add to the chemistry of the band that made it?
Well, we already had a marvelous chemistry, but we were simply a trio, you know, guitar, bass, and drums. So we needed another instrument. And fortunately, Jerry played both keyboards and guitar and played both very well. Some songs he would enhance with keyboards. He had, in the early days, he had a Farfisa organ, an electric piano. Eventually it was a Yamaha CP70. And then later, you know, he graduated to synthesizers and everything. But Jerry was very good at knowing exactly what to do. We never had a problem with him stepping on other people's parts or taking crazy solos or anything like that. He knew exactly what to do, and he improved the texture of the songs, and he also made them more beautiful. So with the four of us, we had a really good thing going.
Sure, you sure did. Looking back on it, do you see those three and then four as those guys over there way in the distance that you remember as some, you know, really cool group? Or do you still see yourself as a, you know, a talking head and you're just a little bit older?
Yeah, the latter. I still think of myself as a talking head. Huh. I mean, you know, and I am a little bit older.
Yes, we are. So what is there a period of the Talking Heads that you like better? Do you like the early band the best? Or when you expanded out with Bernie Worrell and Nona Hendrix and all the rest of them, did that get to be more exciting?
You know, I liked every period. I was Talking Heads to me was a dream come true. And because we had artistic success, I felt. We had critical success. And we always had just enough financial success. I mean, we never made like Michael Jackson or Madonna type money, but we made enough money that we didn't have to worry about our rent. We could finance our own projects. Like, we always paid for our own records. We didn't go with our hat in our hand to the record company because we didn't want the record company coming around the studio saying, "I don't hear a hit single."
Right.
Because we weren't really about, fortunately, we did have some hit singles, but we weren't really about that. Whenever we had a hit, it was like by accident, you know?
Yep, sure. But you had your first song out of the gate became to this day, gets the most hits on Spotify and the rest of those streaming services.
Psycho Killer.
Yeah, Psycho Killer.
Yeah, yeah. The kids love that.
Yeah. Would I be wrong in saying that that's sort of the most autobiographical song for David Byrne? I mean, you start a conversation, you can't even finish it. I mean, it seems about right from what I read in your book, And I think your fans probably saw him as the psycho killer sort of because of his weirdness. You know, he was kind of a strange frontman.
Yeah, I think that bothered David that people associated him, like people used to call him the Tony Perkins of rock and roll. Yeah. And there was a vague resemblance, you know, if you didn't look too closely and you were far away.
Yeah, but he was edgy. And that's what you liked, right? I mean,
yeah. David is a fantastic showman. There are few that are any better, you know.
Sure. Yeah.
And he always was able to attract eyeballs.
Yeah, sure. Your relationship was definitely, from reading the book, bittersweet. I mean, you and him and Tina formed an amazing band, and then you recognized his quirky uniqueness, and you all got into the same groove, really, you know, which was really helpful. I mean, you guys really liked to dance, and that's what people wanted to do in the clubs too, right? And so you had this thing going on for 15 years, but you also described them as socially awkward and distant and not very friendly, and that continues on to today, doesn't it?
Well, you know, it was an imperfect relationship. It was one of those relationships that began very kind of pleasantly, and yes, there may have been awkward moments here and there, but I mean, we lived together for a couple of years, mm-hmm. and there were never any big fights or anything like that. Never. We used to go everywhere together, and you know, it was a wonderful experience. But then as things got more and more serious, David became more and more serious. And I can't say I blame him. I mean, it's, you know, anyway, my feeling was that I knew even early on that bands like Talking Heads don't come along every day. What I realized was it was my dream to put that band together, but putting it together was not as difficult as keeping it together. And that became a real challenge at times, not all the time, but at times, you know, and I imagine lots of bands are like that. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, people like to talk about our band and like all the drama. I mean, you know, there was, hell yes, there was some drama, but it wasn't like an everyday thing.
Sure. It's family, you know, it's like brothers yeah. who fight, and then yeah. you're always going to be brothers, right?
It's very similar to family, and when there's a divorce in the family, and who do you take sides with, you know? Some mm-hmm. people don't want to take sides, other people do want to take sides. So
sure,
I've been dealing with a certain degree of that, you know, comments that I see online and stuff, but regarding my book, and I guess that's how they've always felt. But fortunately, I get a lot of great comments as well.
Sure. And you mentioned that you were interested in straightening out the record, that Talking Heads wasn't just David. That was real important to you, because that's a narrative that happens. I see it all the time. It was yeah. a band that came up with the sound and the groove and the success. It wasn't just David.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, at a certain point, David just stopped mentioning the rest of the band. But it wasn't just with us. It was with everybody in his life. You know, all his old friends, his business associates. He dropped all of those lawyers, accountants, you know, anybody that was connected to the past, or, you know, he just cleaned house. And I believe he does that with a certain frequency.
Sure. Well, you know, some people are just have aversions to attachment, I think. And
yeah,
I know people like that in my life too. They're just moving on.
Yeah. Right.
You know, I thought of this because I read Wheels on Fire, you know, a great book about the band. And I think your situation is sort of similar to the band. Robbie Robinson gets all the credit. You know, he's the leader. He wrote all the songs. And I think I think there's a lot that's similar to you and that situation too. And, you know, I mean, I can point out that Robinson and Byrne really haven't written what you would call a band song or a Talking Head song since the breakup. You know, I mean, you guys put together something that's totally unique, and you can't duplicate it alone. Am I right or wrong?
You're absolutely right. In fact, I remember, look, I don't want to beat up on David because...
Sure, we just have to get through this.
David and I did great work together, and I'm very proud of that work because nobody's breaking down our door for new Talking Head stuff. They're very happy with the old Talking Head stuff. But I can remember when David kind of, in the book I call it, sneaked out of the band. He was out in Los Angeles, and he announced to the... He was doing an interview about one of his solo albums, and he announced to the Los Angeles Times that Talking Heads was no longer working together, that we had, I think he said, we've broken up or whatever you want to call it. My manager, when I found out about it, my manager said, yeah, he's treating you, he's doing a Robbie Robertson.
Oh, wow. So there you go.
Our manager, you know, a guy named Gary Kerfurst, knew a lot about those days, the band's days, you know.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And,
you know, look, the music business is a very difficult business, and you have to stick up for yourself. And sometimes, if you stick up for yourself, they say, "Okay, bye."
I hear you. So do you long for the camaraderie and the sort of that effortless cooperation and inspiration that you had at that specific time? I mean, something.
Those were very good times. And I am a person who enjoys, you know, our own musical history and other bands' musical history. And that's why I wrote this book, because it's a pretty unique history. And I mean, my story is very different than most rock and roll musicians because of my connection with Tina and our longtime romance, which continues to this day.
That's so, so wonderful. I mean, who has that? Is there anybody else in so-called rock and roll?
I think if Linda McCartney were alive, that would probably still be.
Sure, that makes sense.
But sadly, she's not. Somebody told me that little Stephen was, and his wife, Maureen, were married on the same day that Tina and I were, same year, same day. But she's not in the band.
Right. That makes it double difficult.
but I consider myself so lucky, and I hope I was able to convey that in this memoir.
Oh, I think you did. I said right out the get-go that it's a love story. You know, I mean, you guys through thick and thin, you know, remained in love. You know, it's an aptly titled book.
Right.
So let me throw a couple of names at you. Maybe you can give me a couple of lines about things. We have limited time. So how about CBGBs?
CBGBs to me was like the Cavern Club was to the Beatles. It was a kind of, you know, not a very luxurious or fancy place, but it was a place where the bands could play original material and they could, and the audience could really get down if they wanted to. And I don't mean dancing necessarily, but, you know, hammering back shots and beers and stuff.
Getting crazy.
Yeah.
What about Patti Smith?
Patti Smith is the godmother of punk. And she's an amazing performer. She has a real gift. And I would say her first album, maybe her second album too, were right up there with the great albums of all time.
Mm-hmm. The Ramones. They come off kind of surly in your book.
But we had a great relationship with the Ramones. It was just Johnny who was he was a bully, not just to us, but to everybody he was involved with. And that was just his style.
Mm-hmm.
But the Ramones themselves were really nice. And the Ramones to me, they were the first band I ever saw at CBGB's, and they were like a conceptual art project to me. Their songs were really loud and you know, bursts of energy and very short. And they used to in the early days, they would actually stop and argue with each other in the middle of a song. Like, No, Johnny, I don't want to play I Don't Want to Go Down to the Basement. I want to play I Don't Want to Walk Around with You. And, you know, just totally remarkable. And we did many shows with them over the years.
Sure you did. I know one of your favorites is the B-52s.
Yes, the B-52s were another very unique band, and the marvelous sense of humor and a really good, they had a gift for creating a party wherever they went. I think they used to refer to themselves as a tacky little dance band from Georgia. And we did a lot of shows with the Bees also. And in fact, Tina and I played with them for a while. When the drummer decided he wanted to play guitar, and they never had a bass guitar before, they had keyboard bass. So we played with them at the famous Rock in Rio festival. Yeah, that's in the book.
Yeah. Wait, let's one more. How about Lou Reed?
Okay. Lou Reed was one of our musical heroes, and you know, he was. We considered him to be sort of the epitome of cool. We saw him, he was one of the few, you know, sort of established, not that he was really the represented the establishment in music at all, but he was one of the, you know, the stars, one of the few stars that ever came down to CBGB's. And he was almost a regular. One time, the first time he saw us play, he came backstage and he invited us to his apartment, like, come on up to my apartment, let's talk. So we quickly put our gear away and took a splurge on a taxi uptown. He lived near Bloomingdale's of all places. So we took a cab uptown and we went into Lou Reed's apartment, and we chatted and chatted for until the sun came up. And he decided he wanted to produce us. And we thought, wow, you know, we'd only played a few shows. We were still a trio. But the rest of that story is in my book.
Yeah, get the book, right? And you have real high regard for John Cale.
Yes, very high. John is amazing, you know. Lou Reed was crazy when he split with John Cale. But, you know, c'est la vie.
Yep. What are you going to do?
Yeah.
So, you know, in the book you mentioned the first record you bought was Big John. That's so funny. That's so funny that you bought that. I mean, mine was Doo-Wah Diddy from Man for Man.
Oh, that was I love that one too.
Yeah. But, you know, what other songs influenced the path that Chris Franz took to the Talking Heads? I mean, tell us a couple of the ones you mentioned in the book.
Things like Walk, Don't Run by The Ventures. The Beatles came out, so there was a ton of Beatles songs and Rolling Stones songs, but also I got into soul music, and particularly, I mean, everybody knew Motown because that was really, you know, very popular all over the country, but there was a lot of Southern soul music that you didn't hear north of the Mason-Dixon line so much, and one of those people was James Brown. Eventually he crossed over. I think it was with Papa's Got a Brand New Bag.
Yeah.
But another was, all the Stax bands, you know, Booker T and the MGs, Sam and Dave, Otis Redding. Oh my God.
Yeah.
So good.
Monster.
So that drummer was a big influence on me, that Al Jackson Jr., who played with all those bands we just mentioned, and also Al Green. Later in his life, he played with Al Green, and on all those Al Green hits, such as Take Me to the River.
Yep.
Although Al didn't have a hit with it, it was a B-side.
And you, but you had a nice hit with it.
Yeah, our first.
Yeah, it was incredible. That bass line, again, Tina, is taking us down the river.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, Tina came up with some brilliant sounding arrangements on the bass.
Yeah, she did. It's memorable. I mean, everybody knows it as soon as the song starts. You know, it's like Slippery People or even Life During Wartime. I mean, it's...
Yeah. There's some good... Genius of Love.
Yeah, Genius of Love, right there. the Tom, did that come sort of a surprise that that was so successful?
Very pleasant surprise, yes. But I think we knew when we cut Wordy Rapping Hood, that was the first thing we did. And Chris Blackwell of Island Records said, Chris and Tina, come on down to Compass Point and cut a single. And if I like the single, you can do a whole album. So we jumped at that opportunity and we cut this song called Wordy Rapping Hood. And we invited him into the studio to hear, you know, just a rough mix of playback. And he said, whoa, I love this. I'm going to release it as a single and in Europe and Latin America. And meanwhile, I want you to get started on the rest of the album. So he released Wordy Rapping Hood, and it went top 10 in, I think, 7 countries in Europe. Some of them it went to number one. Went to number one in Argentina, and it went to number one in Mexico.
Yeah. It wasn't a hit before any of the Talking Heads songs?
We had hits, but it was our first gold record.
Oh, okay.
You know, that means it sold 500,000 copies. Hmm. Talking Heads had not yet achieved a gold record, except in New Zealand. We got one in New Zealand. They said, hey, mate, you're bigger than Rod Stewart down here.
Oh, that's something. That's pretty funny. My favorite period, I like all the early stuff. I like everything about it. I was a huge Talking Heads fan, so I'm tickled to death to be here talking to you. But my favorite stuff is some of that live material I hear on the name of this band is Talking Heads. Especially the second album, you know. I mean, I love it all, but the second part of it, the second LP, is just off the charts good. And I've seen some of the internet stuff and the some live footage of them, those concerts. And I just want to know, I mean, when you were sitting there behind the drum kit and you're looking out over this massive concert and the crowd is going bananas, what were you thinking to yourself? Is that there was so much out of control fun? I mean, it must have been just crazy.
It really was crazy, you know, crazy good. And I mean, having Steve Scales sitting right beside, you know, Tina on one side and Steve Scales on the other side of me, and Adrian Belew wailing away in front of me, and of course David and Jerry, and then Bernie Worrell throwing musical shapes all over the place, and Dolette McDonald, who was a fantastic singer and always had, I mean, later Dolette went off to join the police because they offered her a lot more money, and who can blame her?
Right. But
then we got the Brides of Funkenstein. And it was just a wonderful, oh, I was going to say this earlier, that we were very fortunate to be in a period of popular musical history where people were very receptive to different things. Like, for example, the way Talking Heads could open a show for the Ramones and people would get very excited by both bands.
Right.
It wasn't like it has to be a heavy metal show or it has to be a country show or a jazz show. You could really mix things up and people dug that. When we did the transition from a 4-piece to 9 pieces on stage, people really dug that. It was celebratory, and I think people were really hungry for something like something that funky.
Sure, yeah. I mean, also, don't you think at that time it was people, not only the audience, but the bands were more receptive to experimenting?
Yeah, well, at least our band was.
Yeah. You definitely were. I mean, you were leading the way.
Right.
How did the African world stuff come in? Who was that? You that brought that to the band, or was it just?
I was definitely one, but actually, Tina and I, and I believe David also had. When we were in college, we had African records in our collection, in our little record collection.
A lot of Nigerian stuff, I bet.
Yeah. I would go up to not just Nigerian, but I would go up to this little multicultural store in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where they sold African things and also things from India, like spices. You could buy a dashiki or you could buy a Fela Kuti album, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I bought a Fela Kuti, I think it was called Africa 70, and I bought Chief Commander Ebenezer Obey, and I bought King Sonny Ade, a very early King Sonny Ade, and I bought Manu Dibango, who I love and still do. So we used to play those at our parties and stuff at RISD, and you know, it was something different and, you know, great for dancing. People found it very exciting, you know. And then later on, when we met Brian Eno, I guess it was the first song that we did was in no way was it African music, nor were we trying to be sound like African music, but we were inspired by African music. It was a song called Izimbra on the Fear of Music album.
Yeah, one of my favorites.
And that when we did that, I think it indicated to all of us that, oh, this is a new path we can take that's not just a sort of more traditional rock and roll format. It's a more wide open, and it involves more, it's just more sexy.
Yeah, it feels great.
Yeah.
Mixed in with all that great funk, you know, it was amazing. You know, you're over your whole career as the Talking Heads, especially you, I mean, you had songs that were just incredible sort of anthems. There was a lot of call and response, you know, I mean, people could sing right along with you some really wild stuff like, you know, This Ain't No Party, This Ain't No Disco. That's an obvious one. How about Slippery People? He's All Right. How Do You Know? Yeah. You know, It was so many of those things were happening. And then, you know, you had Once in a Lifetime, which I think is like one of the great songs about dysfunctional dystopia America today. I mean, it could be played today and be relevant.
Yeah. Well, one of the big sing-alongs was always Psycho Killer.
Right.
You know, the chorus, the end of the chorus, the ay-ay-ay-ay thing. Because in England in particular, it would sound like a soccer match. What do you call those hooligans chant?
That's funny. Well, I thank you for coming to visit. I appreciate you coming on the air. Is there anything else you want to leave us with about the book and your storied career here with Talking Heads and Tom Tom Club?
Well, I'm always very grateful to the fans. I hope they can enjoy my book, whether they buy it or get it from a friend or the library or whatever. Check it out because it's the inside story. Thank you, Kevin.
Thanks a lot for coming on, Chris.